This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 276, where today we're going to talk to JD Trask from Raygun on building at cloud scale. Recorded live October 18th, 2018.
Are you being asked repeatedly to integrate different business systems in ever narrower timeframes and with increasing process complexity? What if you could standardize the way you build these business processes so your team are focusing on higher value tasks versus the nuts and bolts of running the processes and integrations? Nintex can make it happen. With a Nintex platform, workflows from person to person, system to system, to the cloud and back. Got a custom system you want to connect with? No-code extensions let you plug into systems simply and easily using REST and Swagger. With Nintex, work just flows, so your teams can work smarter, work faster, and be more connected than ever. Try it out free for 30 days at www.nintex.com/try NWC.
Morning, AC.
Morning, CJ. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm alive and busy.
So it's like running a small business, right?
Yeah, man. It's been just running around left and right. I was supposed to be doing a user group talk tonight. Just found out that we're postponing it because we didn't announce it, what the topic was, until about 5 days ahead of time. So there wasn't much time for people to sign up for it. And we've got a handful of signups, but when you remove the organizers, the speaker, and the host for the event, and then you factor in the percentage of people who normally attend, let's just say it might be more of a coffee than a presentation.
Yes. Maybe you'd be better at grabbing them and taking them for a beer.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what I was suggesting, but I think that what we're going to do just punt it for a little bit. So
we have a mutual friend who did a session at, I think it was at an Ignite or an Inspire or something. I can't remember what it was now. Some conference, and one person showed up for a session, and he was on stage, and he was just like, "Let's go downstairs to the bar and have a beer, and we can just talk, shoot the breeze about whatever you like." So maybe that's the way to go.
I wouldn't mind it, but. Yeah, maybe not the most legit or way to go through and to present, but anyway.
Fair enough.
How about you, man? What you been up to?
Oh, cracking along. Trying to sell a house. Not going very well, but bummed out about it. Not the end of the world either. So yeah. No news on that.
Mm.
But also on a somber note, Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft, passed away this week from complications due to a cancer that he had, and not new to him, in fairness. He'd battled with this for decades, but... Obviously, he was one of the originals with Bill Gates, who before, mm-hmm. Right in the early days, got Bill to drop out of university, and they started Microsoft together. And it's been amazing watching the reaction, not just around the world, but especially in Seattle. The city is in mourning, for sure. He was a huge influence on the area, just from the landmarks that he's built, like museums and sports teams here, and did a lot of philanthropic work in the area. And it's just been really fascinating to see the region react to his passing and how sad everybody is. He made a huge impact. So, yeah, sorry to drag us down with that, but obviously a big deal for people that are involved in the space that we talk about. And Microsoft, we obviously wouldn't all be here today without a lot of the original work that he'd put in and in growing Microsoft. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. He obviously was one of the forefathers of a lot of the stuff that we did. I mean, it was him and Bill Gates that really kicked off the whole PC world on the Microsoft side. Yeah, and it's just, I mean, they were the ones responsible for it. And I know that they followed after Microsoft. They kind of followed very different paths. But and he's been he's been quiet quite a bit. But it's it's sad to always see somebody, to lose somebody like that. And I was curious to see, from afar, I mean, you saw stuff in social and in the media and the tech media talk about it. But outside of that, you didn't see a whole lot of people really mentioning it all that much. The newsflash, I was on the phone with somebody from Microsoft on a business call, and all of a sudden my phone buzzes and it's Paul Allen's passed away. And it's that call was a totally different tone the rest of the call.
Yeah, I bet.
Sad, but I guess should be more of a celebration of his life.
Absolutely. And, he's done a lot of good, and I guess his legacy will continue with his foundation and with his sister, who I believe is taking over a lot of that stuff and his work going on. Everything from sort of ocean-based research and going and finding wrecks, a lot of World War II wrecks and other things like that, through to his his work he's doing with space, building rockets and launch vehicles and things like that and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, his legacy will continue.
Yeah, not Rex like the kind that you and I end up dealing with every once in a while.
No. No, like your proper ones at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, interesting ones.
Yeah. Also in other news, Docker has raised $92 million in new funding. I'm not sure how I feel about this, honestly. I think they're in a bit of trouble, but it'll be interesting to see if this pulls them through the other side. I thought they've been in a little bit of strife for a while and trying to commercialize their product lineup and make some money eventually. And yeah, I'm not sure how you feel about this, but obviously good news for them that, you know, they're able to push forward with a new set of capital to go and push into their products and things. But I just found it kind of interesting.
That is interesting. I missed this until you mentioned it. Now I'm looking at the link here. Scanning the article here, does it say who the big funder was of this? Like where the money came from?
Not that I'm aware of. I haven't dug into it too much.
Getting through, it doesn't look like it doesn't.
Yeah, they're in a bit of trouble with, well, I think they're at least in a bit of trouble. They're trying to commercialize Docker, basically. And they're putting all their eggs in Docker Enterprise Edition and so forth. And that's a really tough problem to crack because they're trying to go after the enterprise market. And building a sales team is a very costly exercise. And they could hire a relatively small sales team and spend all of that $92 million on it.
Yeah, and that's fair. But I mean, you know, let's take a step back here. I'm going to read some stuff from the article because they make some good points where they've raised $92 million for a targeted $192 million funding round. Yeah, so they're
going for a couple hundred.
Yeah, they're going for about 200 is what they're going for. And they are currently still valued at over $1 billion as one of the unicorns. And they've got previous investors of people like Goldman Sachs, Benchmark, Greylock Partners, AMD Cloud Ventures, and Quartu Management. There are some big backers there. But I mean, you're right. It's a challenge where it's an open source tech that originally started as like an open source technology that the world, you know, embraced and absolutely loved, and people have taken off with it. And unfortunately, that the marketing or the business side, at some point, you've got to make some money for the company to survive. And the way they're doing is going after the enterprise space. And I think they're, you know, in trouble is one way to look at it. I guess another way you could look at it too is that, you know, they're just trying to find their place now. They've defined, did a really good job of defining or putting some structure around this container space that was kind of there before, but what really wasn't like a popular kind of a thing. Now it is. And they're just trying to find their space now to make sure they can survive.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Maybe in trouble is the wrong word. They're in that sort of flux period of they've got some really amazing tech and now they need to figure out how to make some money from it.
Yeah, that's true. I have one quick little thing I'll post too. I'll mention is that the Uber engineering blog put a really cool post out in the last day or two. It talks about how they deal with big data, and it kind of walks through their evolution of here's how it was when we started, then here's how we moved, you know, to the next stage and the next stage, and, you know, introducing things like Spark and Hadoop and Kafka and all that. And then now they're on the whole, like, you know, where are we going next? It's here are our main things that we're focusing on and what we've got to deal with. And it was a really interesting read just to watch somebody like dealing with a problem that I don't have to deal with, but it's how you're going about it and trying to, you know, trying to rebuild the car as you're driving across country. You can't stop. You got to keep going. So it's interesting. Yeah. Interesting piece there about Uber Big Data Platform is the blog post, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes.
Excellent, excellent. So we have a pretty exciting interview lined up. I shouldn't say pretty. That sounds like it's only half-baked, but we have a very exciting interview this week. We're really fortunate to have a great set of sponsors for the show. And from time to time, we like to invite folks from those companies that are doing interesting things on the show and talk to them about what they're up to. We originally spoke to JD from Raygun a couple of years ago now, I think it was. It's a wee while back. And, you know, they've been doing some really interesting stuff in the cloud. Great bunch of guys doing interesting things in the cloud. And so back then we spoke to them about what they were doing with their crash reporting. And I believe at the time, soon to be their new Pulse tool coming to market. But a lot has changed in the last couple of years. And they're dealing with things like, speaking of big data, lots and lots of data and dealing with things at cloud scale. And so we felt, hey, what better time to invite JD back on the show to catch us up on what they've been doing in the cloud, what they're doing with their products, what they're seeing going on in the industry, and some of the challenges they've faced in building software for the cloud. So without further ado, welcome JD to the show.
Thanks, CJ. It's a pleasure to be back.
Hey, I know I've just invited you to the show, but why don't we pause very briefly to hear from us about you, and we'll be back.
Struggling to reproduce problems in your code base? Successful software starts with Raygun. Raygun provides application performance monitoring, unlike anything you've experienced before, offering greater clarity around how your software is performing for your customers than any other APM provider. Easily detect and diagnose issues impacting end users and monitor every part of your stack in one place. It's time to get back to building great software instead of fighting it. Start your journey to better software quality. Try Raygun free at raygun.com today.
How did you feel about that? Us talking about you.
Glorious.
There you go. Well, no, thank you very much for coming on the show again. We really appreciate the time, obviously. You guys are doing fascinating stuff in the cloud, but for those of you who didn't get the full gist of what Raygun is doing from our sponsor spot or want a little more detail, why don't you tell us in your own words what Raygun is all about?
Yeah, sure. When we first launched Raygun, it was a crash reporting product. So we integrated into people's code and we collected up any of the software errors that they had and reported them back to our product and could tell people, hey, here's all the issues you have, go and fix them. And that worked with about 25 different programming languages, which was pretty cool. And as you said, we launched the Pulse product, which we've subsequently renamed Real User Monitoring. And that's tracking the experience that your users have. So what's the load time of things? How long are they waiting on stuff to load? What sort of API calls might be impacting that sort of thing? But very customer end user focused there. And then more recently, about a month ago now, we launched Raygun APM. So that stands for Application Performance Monitoring, where we can track what's happening on the server and tell you about what's happening there and perhaps how the performance is being impacted by the code that's executing on the server. So you can kind of imagine it like a Venn diagram. You've kind of got the bits that are blowing up, the crash reporting, you know. Well, I think of it as a black box flight recorder, right? Like, things do blow up a lot and we can tell you what happened. And then the real user monitoring is telling you about, how much enjoyment, shall we say, are your users having with your software? Is it fast and snappy and are they having a good time? And then now we can sort of overlay that with saying, well, how does the server play a part in this? And that kind of gives you the most integrated view of the whole health and way that your software is running that out of basically anyone in the market today. So that's really exciting for us. There's an ongoing challenge in how we adopt additional languages. Like I said, crash reporting works with about 25 different programming languages. Real user monitoring pretty much covers everything you need because that only needs to go into the layer that the user sees, so JavaScript or native mobile bindings. And then APM, at the moment we support .NET with that, but we'll be rolling out support for Java and Ruby and Python and Node and all those sorts of things in the coming year. So
yeah, I guess that makes, I like the way you explain that about the Venn diagram because, you know, it's one thing to know if your software is falling over, but the next question is why, right? And I guess APM helps you fill that gap in. And then it's also, you know, it's one thing to know how user performance is going or how their experience is overall. But if the graph dips and you're not sure why, then you've still got more work to go do. So I guess having that sort of trifecta of monitoring and insight and telemetry is really, really impactful as an app developer, right? Being able to see that sort of those three angles on things.
Absolutely. And the way to think about it as well, and you touched on it there, we're seeing the line dip, right? We like to think about it as being that a lot of the tools in the market today, they're pretty good. But oftentimes all they're going to give you is that the chart dipped and then you kind of go, all right, cool. Now I've got to figure out why did it dip?
Yep.
our approach has always been that all of the charts are pretty much computed off of the raw trace data. Mm. And then across APM, RUM, and crash reporting. So we don't drop the data. We store all the raw stuff and all of that. So you can look at the dip and go, okay, let me compare between here and here and what was the delta between the two. Mm. So that way you go from thinking, well, now I've got to spelunk around with log files and waste, days maybe trying to figure something else versus just looking in there. And one of the things that's really blowing my mind, and, this is the cloud show, so I think it makes sense to talk about, is so many of these tools in the space, they don't store the trace data, or they throw it away so quickly because of cost of storage. And sure. I cannot figure out why they do that. I mean, I was looking at some of the other APM tools as we were coming to market. Some of them only have like 2 or 3 days worth of data retention. Yeah. And you know, bloody expensive products. I'm like, I don't like the idea of a long weekend where I come back in and I kind of go, oh, the chart dipped, but I don't know why. Like, that's gone. You know,
so Monday, it was on Friday, you can't see what's going on.
Absolutely. So we store everything, and I look at it as kind of going, you know what, it is costly, but that's my problem to solve, not the customers. You know, that's what they're paying me to figure out. So, right.
That's a really good point, because it's, you know, I guess the age-old software developer's problem is, you know, Monday morning comes along and boss or exec comes in and goes, I was off at the horse races with our customer Foo, and they said that your software performs really poorly and you need to do something about it. And most software developers sit there and scratch their head and go, well, that's not very much to go on. And, you know, it's that age-old, you know, throw the turd over the fence and let engineering deal with it. But, you know, one of the things I think I mentioned on our last episode with you, I think it was back at episode 133, was when we had you on back in 2016, June the 14th, 2016, in fact.
You've got a good memory. I must be very memorable.
AC's on the case here.
I'm in the background. So, I know how to search.
When I said I think, I actually know. Yeah, anyway. one of the things we talked about back then was when I started Hyperfish, one of the things I wanted was when something went wrong, I want all the telemetry right from the very beginning, because I know eventually this is going to come and bite us in the butt and the horse will have bolted and it's kind of too late to know what's going on. And so having all of that telemetry at your fingertips and being able to dig in when the boss comes in and starts, you know, railing you over, why is this thing going slow? It might not be because of a crash. It might be because of some sort of network issue between the customer and your server, or it might be something behind the scenes, and being able to, you know, pivot around that and see where it is, obviously, super important. But yeah, no good if your data goes missing after a couple of days.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we get this all the time. So Raygun monitors itself, which I think is really cool. I kind of have this dream idea that the product just becomes better and better because it keeps telling us what to improve about itself, which I think is kind of neat. But
is that, you know, like infinite recursion though?
Yes. But who doesn't like that? I mean,
it is a magical concept. Yes.
Well, especially given its infinite recursion towards a better product. Right?
Yes.
So it's like a genetic algorithm that's just trending towards awesomeness. But we get customers who get in touch and they'll say something like that, you know, hey, I've had something's gone wrong or whatever. And one of the things that's really neat is you just bang in their email address in Raygun and kind of go, oh, well, here's every session they've had. Here's every error they've had. Here's this now with Raygun APM. You know, here's every server-side trace that they've had. We can actually dig in there and kind of have a look. So they might say, oh, this was slow. And you can go in and go, oh, okay, yeah, actually, they did get an outlier in the P99 range of, like, say, 15-second load time. What the hell happened there?
Yes.
And now you can kind of put in the full x-ray and kind of go, well, was it something that happened at the front end? Maybe it was a JavaScript on a third party that just blocked the render for ages, or maybe we have a really crappy database query that's running behind the scenes and it's a large-scale customer. Who knows? Well, Raygun knows, so that's useful.
Nice. So with APM, if I was building a server-side application, maybe it's behind the scenes of a web application or or an API or something like that, what do I have to do to get this thing working on my application? And then do I have to go write more code to go and instrument it? Like, how do you operate in terms of getting that set up?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, well, let's break it down on all the products in case some of the listeners are Raygun users today, which is that you integrate an SDK for crash reporting and real user monitoring. You just reference in the library. There's a couple of value adds you can do with some extra instrumentation, but typically it takes 10, 15 minutes. APM is a different kettle of fish because what's going on is it needs to effectively profile the running application, and you can't do that, at least in .NET, you can't do that from like within the process itself. Okay, you have to attach a profiler to start feeding information. And that's the classic story of needing to install an agent on the server. So we're no different in that regard, that you have to install the agent and put it on there. We have done some work to support some of the PaaS style capabilities of, say, is it Azure websites? mm-hmm. where you don't access the actual box. So we actually have an extension for that. So you can put that in without having to, quote unquote, connect to the server and install the agent. Yeah. And so that attaches the profiler and can then basically track what's going on in the application. The agent then does a bit of work around that to package it up, sanity check things and whatnot, and then send it off to the service and batches. So, yeah, it's a little bit different, but it's still doesn't take too long.
So can I do things like, can I raise events from within my code? Like if I want to capture certain scopes or contexts, you know, like in a microservice-based app, this is kind of tough work, right, where you've got, say you've got 20 level microservices and they're all doing different parts, fulfilling different parts of the request or part of the process or whatever. How do you deal with like flowing context across all of those and wrapping some sort of scope around it so you know that it's all part of the same request, for example?
Yeah, so that's typically referred to as distributed tracing. So the idea of being able to take a trace that it goes across services or different domains. Today, right now, that's not in Raygun APM. That's something, the classic software challenge, right? Do we want to launch this thing or do we? so we've put it out there and we're rapidly iterating, but we are definitely bringing out support for distributed tracing because we actually want that ourselves. You know, have the same challenges and we do actually have the ability to collect the traces from all the different pieces. It's just the stitching it together.
Yeah, gotcha.
And so you can usually do that with a trace ID that basically gets attached to the request that go through. And if you're clever enough, you can make it so that happens automatically without having to do any sort of instrumentation manually to achieve
that. Yep. That sounds extremely familiar for some reason.
To that point, too, I mean, because a lot of the stuff that you talk about is, you know, you want to install something on the server to be able to monitor and profile and everything. But, you know, there are other scenarios, too, that people are running into. I guess I'm thinking now, as CJ just described a scenario that is very near and dear to him. I got one that's near and dear to me. You know, let's talk about people who are, like, doing, like, a pure client-side development. So, like, if you're a SharePoint framework developer and you're building stuff that's just running in the client, or as my business runs, where I run based off a bunch of hosted SaaS products or SaaS offerings, and then I stitch them together to make one site, but I have no server-side access to anything. I can put some JavaScript stuff in there and I can try and instrument things there, but like when a user says, hey, I'm having a problem that this thing isn't working, there's not a whole lot that I can do, but I can, you know, add some stuff to go through and add that. And I mean, I see that Raygun does have a client-side component to it as well. But I mean, what would you, for people that are in that kind of a scenario, is it really more of a complementary thing that you want to do that client-side, you know, monitoring and stuff? Or is it that it really doesn't give you that much benefit unless you've got the server piece to it as well? Like what do you say for people that are in that kind of a scenario?
So in your scenario, the real user monitoring part would be key. You can imagine it along the lines of the data that RUM is going to provide is going to say, here is the timings that all of the users actually experienced and what goes into that timing. And we'll use a web app as an example, though we do support mobile as well. You can see how much time went into things like the DNS lookup, SSL handshake, the transferring of data, the loading of child assets. We generate a full waterfall of all the assets loading. But one piece in there that's always interesting is the server time. So what was the response time from the server? That's the piece where you would at least get a kind of a direction, like, oh, okay, this page is slow because it was something to do with the server. And then where you're saying, hey, I don't necessarily have easy access to that part of the story, at least you'd know that's where the problem was lying, right? And at that point, depending on if it was a desktop app or, hey, there was a whole set of these different services, or maybe it was a PaaS or something like that, you can go and start exploring in whatever way you need to there. Our goal, obviously, longer term, like with the Azure websites, is to make sure that we support as many PaaS systems as we can. But that would be where you'd start. And certainly, you don't need APM to make real user monitoring valuable. I always think it's been fascinating launching the crash reporting product because developers really kind of get that, you know, throwing a 500 error and giving an error page to the user is a pretty suboptimal experience.
But wait, hold on a second.
Yeah.
CJ, are you taking notes on the whiteboard back there?
Yeah. Let me write this down. Suboptimal. Okay. Yeah.
But the thing that I'm seeing is an interesting thing that's happening in the industry is that a lot of devs don't actually appreciate the performance as a feature. Right. Mm-hmm. And the bit that makes it even more interesting to me is it's actually getting driven more out of the marketing teams. And the reason it's being driven out of the marketing teams is because Google started saying, we're going to savage your rank if your site is slow. because they know that slow, you know, performance is a feature. They want you to have a best outcome of clicking on their links. And so suddenly we're getting all these marketing teams going, yeah, we know our website or our web app's dog slow. No one in the engineering team seems to be at all worried about this. And so they drive that. And then once that's in there, you know, the dev team kind of goes, oh, well, we've worked out that it's these particular routes that are really slow, and we start looking into it and all that. So that holistic software quality thing is really important, I think. And I don't really care where it gets driven in by, but the whole team should care about it.
Mm. Yeah, so I guess, where did this come from? Like, what led you to, so you had crash reporting, you had real user monitoring, what formerly was Pulse, and sort of the third wheel, I guess, well, it's not really. It's the third sort of facet to the thing. Where did that come from? Was it some sort of pet project internally that somebody was like, oh, yeah, we've got to monitor our own stuff, and holy smoke, this is probably useful to somebody else? Or did it come from, hey, Reagan, we want to throw millions and millions of dollars at you, but we really want this server-side monitoring stuff as well as your crash reporting and user monitoring? Like, what sort of, where did it come out of?
Yeah, well, it was actually multifaceted in its own right. So just about almost every customer we have was like, we love how you've approached these problems already. We're writing these big checks to these other APM companies. We'd really love to see your twist on this. We'd be quite happy to do that. Now, I will say it was not a question of just saying, hey, well, there's more money to be made there. It was based on the customer demand to do it. It was also a case that we believed that we could do a better job at it than the existing players that were out there. We saw a need for it ourselves. So Raygun crash reporting originally came out of that as well. We were kind of building something like it for ourselves. They're kind of the three key tenants that we want to see. Customer demand, we would use it ourselves, and we have a unique twist on it. They're the important tenants. We've actually built entire products internally before where we've got them to the MVP stage and just kind of gone, look, we can't figure out, we're just not that passionate about it. You know, we can't figure out a unique twist on this, and we shut it down. And that can be after spending significant amount of money like looking into it. So that was the driver. We also, if you broke it down by saying, what can we tell technology teams about their software, the server was a bit of a black hole for us. And so this plugged that gap as well. That's been good. We still get people now asking for other little things around it, but that was lesser large gaps, I guess, in there. Yeah, gotcha. I will say one of the things that slowed us down in delivering the product, though, was the amount of value it was providing to our own team, and that it auto-reports a lot of common software mistakes. For example, it will automatically pick up if you're generating N+1 query problems. And so the team were running it against Raygun itself in development and then kind of going, oh, I know I've got to build this feature, but I really want to go and fix that thing that it's told me it should be.
So like, if we turn this on and show JD, he's going to send the things to go look at. We better fix them now.
Well, that's one of our twists, right, is that going back to that point about most APM tools or these sorts of tools give you a pretty chart that goes down and up, we were like, well, wouldn't it be better if we could actually just tell you about an issue. So CJ, you've used Raygun crash reporting. You know about how we group the errors together and you kind of go, okay, well, these are the thing tasks I have to do. We wanted to bring that to APM where you get this issues list where it's like, well, here's an N+1 issue over here and one over here and here's a timing issue. And you can actually assign them to team members and make it much more about how does the team work together to go and make this stuff better rather than, oh God, the chart moved, make a JIRA ticket, you know, that sort of thing. So
nice. And even with crash reporting, you guys were starting to face some really quite interesting cloud scale problems, I guess, for want of a better word, where even crash reporting started generating a ton of traffic to you guys. We're a small application, relatively speaking, and we generate loads of these things. Not all of them are things we have to go resolve. Some of them are just interesting sort of informational type stuff that we want to know about and we want reported on. So that must generate an absolute boatload of traffic and some interesting cloud scale issues. And then you go add to it the APM side of the fence, which is, it's a constant stream of information, not just when an event happens, but, you know, even when the application's perfectly healthy, you're generating a boatload of data. I'd love to know some of the technical challenges that you've faced over the last couple of years, A, in building APM, but also in crash reporting and your other products. in building something that scales to the degree that it does. Because, you know, quite frankly, from our side, I've never seen an issue with crash reporting. And that kind of blows my mind, because most people have scaling issues, and either you're doing a really good job of covering it up and scaling really fast, or you're doing something really right. I'd love to hear a few of the challenges around cloud scale and building, as you guys have expanded with some really big customers and things, some of the stuff you thought, holy smoke, didn't think we'd be dealing with this.
Yeah, well, it's been an experience, and you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't say a big part of it comes down to the fact that the team care deeply about providing the best product they can. And so we do a bunch of things internally to ensure that the engineering team, so we're a DevOps practice, meaning, you know, we don't have an ops team that just makes sure stuff stays up and fast. The engineers own that. Similarly, the engineers deal with, we have non-technical people also involved in, say, support queries that come through. But typically, they, if it's anything technical, it's routed to the engineer who worked on it. So they feel the pain that the customers feel, which is always an important thing. There's a kind of relatively sort of famous business view that as soon as you disconnect who feels the pain versus who can resolve the pain, you've got a problem, right? And so the team is a big part of how it's managed to stay up, not go down. But I would say the overall performance story, I kind of think of as being a bit of a sawtooth graph. So every time we make the system really, really fast, about 6 months later, it's starting to creak under the load of just increased data volumes, more customers, that sort of thing. We have to kind of think outside the box again on that. Mm. We look for performance everywhere. I know this is a bit of it's a tech show, but for those that are curious, even with all of this data, so like you say, crash reports when stuff goes wrong, which happens more than people would like to admit. RUM is tracking every single action that an end user has in a piece of software. And now APM is also tracing what happened on the server for all of those. Right? We operate this business at the moment at about an 85% gross margin. So our cost to serve is dirt low. And the reason for that is because we just keep putting more and more effort into the performance story, because that allows us to take the remainder and invest in ourselves. So we're not a VC-backed company. It's not like my answer to performance is to say, well, I hand Jeff Bezos, you know, $1 million check every day and make sure that it's fast. That
sort of stay lean and mean and
fly. Yeah. So I typically sit there as the CEO of the company and obviously annoyingly technical as well, and sort of go, wait, why am I paying for all these service guys? You know, optimize this stuff, make it faster. And so we spend a lot of time on it, which is why, you know, in the last podcast, we talked about moving to .NET Core on the API, because that meant we lowered our cost to serve on the API layer substantially with that change. We keep looking at these changes. We've moved more parts of the processing pipeline to .NET Core in the midterm, that sort of thing. And we also do these R&D projects internally. So I touched on the fact that everybody seems to expire this data really quickly because it's expensive. Well, years ago, we did a really huge project internally where we said, okay, well, what would be a way that we could store all of this and make it fast and cheap for us to deliver to the customers? Now, obviously, there was a cost in terms of building that and software engineers' time, but it's paid dividends for years to come. And we currently have another R&D project underway at the moment, which is around that performance of load time that users experience within the app. So there are parts of the system that are a little slower than others. Like, for example, you mentioned crash reporting. At the moment, that's certainly an area where we're working to improve that. It's not terrible. It just could be faster. So we're trying to improve that in there. But certainly making sure that the system is always up so we can keep ingesting the data. We always think of the API as, and knock on wood here, basically needs 100% uptime, right? The app, maybe a little less. You know, if the app's down for 5 minutes, that's not a huge deal. As long as we don't lose your data, that's the key thing. And so the whole team's pretty aware of that when we're designing and architecting different parts of the platform. There's also redundancy built in on the various bits that matter the most. I don't know. I mean, that's quite a long, broad answer for you there, CJ.
No, it makes sense. I really like the idea of, you know, you were talking when we last spoke about starting to move to .NET Core, that you were able to drive some really good cost savings and getting more scale, I guess, more throughput out of less using .NET Core for your API. I imagine you've taken that forward with APM and all that as well. But I love that concept of just the API being like as dumb as possible, I think was how you used to describe it last time. Was it's really just a thing that catches stuff and sticks it somewhere else. Yep. And really it's super, it doesn't have a lot of brains, right? It just knows what to take, where to where to take the data from and where to put it.
Yeah.
You have processes that deal with that behind the scenes, and that really keeps it in fighting shape and quick.
The most complicated thing in the API is actually the rate limiting. And right. we don't tend to rate limit anyone except when it's clear that there's something severely wrong. So, right. for example, we had one customer who was, this was about 3 weeks ago, and they were generating, I think it was 26,000 errors per second. And that was all streaming through. And about a day into this, you know, the team was talking about it. It's like, I'll ring them up. You know, I'm just like, hey, you kind of aware that, I don't know, like every mouse move somebody's is generating an error.
Somebody's written a while loop with
through. Yeah. Well, we joke that we should put on the enterprise plan that the alerting features include a phone call from the Raygun CEO if it gets a bit out of hand. But the thing was, we just handled it, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. It didn't affect any other customers. It didn't even really affect them. I mean, other than their poor users who were clearly hating life. But yeah, you just handle it.
Yeah, nice. And situations like that, you can't make it that your number one priority in engineering is to make sure things like that work flawlessly every time. But knowing that you can cope with spikes like that and not fall over it's an engineer's panacea. Is that the right word? I guess sort of. You know, it's like a dream for them to be able to deal with massive spikes, not completely fall over. But having said that, you know, not necessarily making it your priority one, you know, feature of your product.
Yeah, absolutely. It gives you confidence, right? Scale. Yes. I mean, we've got some massive companies on Raygun today. I mean, one of my favorites is Domino's Pizza, right? They've been using us for years, all through their online stuff. They have massive spikes in data volumes when, you know,
Super Bowl,
yep, comes on. We have retailers on there when Black Friday comes along, Cyber Monday, no issues around that. And not having to worry about it. It's interesting, though, because you can see that customers are very used to people falling over. So they'll usually reach out and be like, hey, so you know that there's a really big day coming up for us and want to make sure you can handle it. And it's kind of like, yep, cool. so that's kind of nice to be able to handle that for sure.
Nice. So as these things as your products have come to fruition, you know, they start as ideas or they start as input from customers and things, and you've spoken about ideas that never made it and things, what's some of the process, I guess, that goes into deciding what you're going to build? Do you sort of treat it as like, we'll wait until X many customers ask for this or before they're going to pay us so much money that we can't really ignore them anymore? Or
that sounds like a high quality problem. Oh, yeah, exactly. Fine, I'll take your money and I'll build your damn thing.
Yeah, exactly. Even if you don't want to, you know, okay, fine. Or do you sort of incubate these things as startup ideas within Raygun? Like, what's some of the process of commercializing a product like this, right? And I'm sure there's lots of devs that are listening to this or lots of techie folks that have side projects and stuff at home or in their personal lives where they've thought, man, I've got this really cool idea and I just want to sort of grow it and commercialize it. I've always thought some of the same decision points go into it when you're running a business that you would doing it, you know, as a side project. But I'm keen to learn, like, how do you guys make the decision from a business perspective of taking a technical idea and turning it into a business reality?
Yeah, so that's a broad set of questions. But so I would say,
how do you make the right decision, JD? How do you get it right? Because these three products seem to be hitting the nail on the head, but it sounds like there's some casualties along the way as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd be remiss if I didn't sort of say, you know, I started my business career when I was 23 years old. We built a lot of different products and not all of them worked. You know, that was early on, was really putting the training wheels on and trying to figure out, you know, how do we identify a demand? How do we know the difference between a person who says they want something versus a person who's willing to pay for something? And I try and take some of that experience. I've done a couple of investments into other startups and sort of help them work on commercializing their software. So I'll probably talk a little bit about that as well as our process. Today at Raygun, I'll cover our process first, which is, we do have enough customers that there's certain sort of obvious things we should be doing. That's helped immensely once you get to scale. When you're starting out and you really have no clue other than, say, friends and family, that's really hard to figure out. We're not probably going to build another core product in the next 12 months. The three we've got is fine. In some ways, I feel like I owe that to the team. So they, you know, get off the treadmill for a little bit and can pay down some technical debt and, you know, tighten up all the bits that they wanted to work on, but didn't quite make it to be one. So we're heavily influenced by the customers, but also our passion to do it. So for example, one of the products that we built was a logging platform. And the thing was, we just couldn't get, at Raygun at least, we couldn't get excited about logging. It wasn't enough for us. And I'm not saying we'd never build a logging product, but I would really need to find somebody who was super passionate about logging.
Gotcha.
Now, I imagine that'd be great to drink with, but...
No doubt.
But people are passionate about a lot of things. But coming back to the point, here's a few things that I've sort of picked up over the years. If you're building a product and it's your first one, try as fast as you can to get to 100 customers. Even if that means you charge way less, don't make it $0. So what I mean by this is you get to 100 paying customers, you kind of start to get statistically significant feedback. So if you've got 10 customers and one asked for something, that might be the same one ask if there was 10,000 customers. You don't really know how to prioritize based on customer feedback. So first 100 customers is just really about trying to get that feedback in there. That's far more valuable to you than the actual dollars coming in the door, because you can improve your decision-making. The second one is, and I see this all the time with devs, and I've never understood this market of people who are generally incredibly highly paid but seem to think money's kind of icky. You know, they don't want to build the part that builds people, you know. I mean, total tangent, and this probably makes some people hate me, but I can't figure out this whole thing of people getting really upset about how companies should be donating money for open source software. It's like you created something of value and then you put it on your front lawn, and you're upset that they didn't leave a pile of cash out of the goodness of their own heart. Like, if you create something of value and you want to be paid for it, put a price on it. Like,
right.
It's not that complicated. This is how the whole rest of the world works.
Do you think that stems from them just lack of background in on the business side of...
Yep. I think that's part of it, but I would say even, and he's a good friend of mine, so I won't name him, but I invested in his startup and we would have these weekly calls and he's like, oh yeah, I've built this feature and this feature and this user loves this. And I'm like, cool, that's great. How's the billing engine going? Oh, I haven't started it. And this just went on and on and on. And it got to the point where I said, look, I'm not going to come to these meetings until you put in place the billing thing. And he's like, oh, but I want Raygun as a customer. Can you pay me? And I said, yeah, when I can put in the credit card. And he said, oh, I'll just send you an invoice. I'm like, no. Yeah. When I can put in the credit card, build the billing system. And this was a guy... Yeah, well, he did, because we sold that startup, which was good. But it just, now he was a guy that was starting a business, so I don't think it's that he didn't think it had to make money. But there was just something in there that meant I'd much rather work on these cool features than the mechanics of it being a business.
Yep.
And just don't put that off. Now, admittedly, you know, in the last 5-10 years, companies like Stripe and that have made that a lot easier for people to do and all of that. But yeah, you've got to put in the business model and actually make the money. There's nothing quite as liberating as starting to have that cash come in, especially if it's a side project, right? You start going, oh, there could be some legs on something. This thing.
It makes it feel a little easier, I guess.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting point. Nobody's going to pay you if they can't pay you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's kind of...
And generally speaking, nobody will pay you even if you don't make them pay you. I have a friend who's got another startup, and he was telling me, he's like, I've got these customers. And I was like, cool. And he's like, and I've got like, say, I think it was like 100 trials. I was like, oh, okay, so what's your conversion to paid? And he's like, oh, it's about this. I was like, that seems really low. And he said, yeah, I've been using some screen recording software, and I noticed that they just dismissed the prompt to pay. And I was like, wait. They can dismiss the prompt. Like, I was like, dude, pay wall, right? Like, if I could walk into a 7-Eleven and they just sort of said, do you want to pay for that today? And I could say no, like, and just walk out the door, like no one would pay at 7-Eleven. So there's a lot of little things like that where it's like, unfortunately, it can feel kind of like scary, because I think that's the thing. I think it's also a fear of rejection at the core level. They might not like it. And the thing is, I think a lot of people know that plenty of people will say they'll pay for something, and then when they actually come to having to put in the credit card, that's when it's like, no. And you're like,
but that is the real test. That's where the rubber really hits the road, right?
And that's why you need to put it in so early. And that's also why I think it's such a joke that you see all these like freemium services as well. It's kind of like, yeah, you can collect up a lot of users, sure. But if they're not willing to pay $1, Well, I remember reading this thing once that said that even in a giveaway, you should charge $1. There's a basically around human psychology is that once somebody has actually made an investment into it, they'll use it. If you give it away for free, you're actually telling that person, we don't even value it.
Yeah, yeah. It's the classic Costco model, right? The membership costs very little in comparison, but every time you think, I'm going to go shopping for some toilet paper or whatever, you're not going to go to the other shop because you've paid a buck.
Made a commitment. Yep.
To Costco, so you go there instead.
Absolutely. And that's why I think you get a lot of these people that kind of think, oh, well, we'll collect up, you know, a million free users. And one day we'll figure out a revenue plan. It's like, no. You've collected up the million users who are never going to pay you a penny, right? Yeah. The conversion rate's pretty low. So that's one of the things we've always done at Raygun. And I always find it interesting. We have some competitors out there that say that they've got like a million developers on their platform. We've got about 75,000, but no one uses Raygun for free, right? And so they have got free ones. I'm like, knowing how conversion rates and freemium work, pretty sure they're not really winning, and it's not 1999 and nobody cares about eyeballs anymore. So, I don't know, freemium has a place, but I just don't think it's the right place, especially if you're looking at a side project that you're going to make available to people. Get people to pay.
Yeah, fair enough. And even if you don't feel comfortable with it early, it's still, you know, as a developer, right, you're saying devs typically shy away from the stuff. But and feel it's a little cringy up front and all that sort of stuff. But the pain is dealing with that personal feeling is better to do up front than later on.
Well, the point is as well is if you're not taking the money, then the service goes away. I mean, all of us know how many times we've seen those hacker news threads of company going out of business, and you kind of look at it and you're like, they just didn't actually make money. They were afraid to make money.
Yeah, gotcha. And,
I love paying for stuff because I know that it will usually get better and it'll stay alive.
Well, I think it surprises developers too, because when they actually go about doing that, I know I felt in the same boat for a lot of the stuff that I was doing, but then when you finally start charging for something, you also find that inhibition that people have to pay for it, that you think that people have to pay for it, once they actually pay for it, you start seeing people actually buying what you're having to offer. It's like, what was I scared of in the first time? Because they are actually paying for it. And then you kind of have to, somebody else has to tell you this until you have to hear it enough times and finally you have to realize it, where it's, if they don't want to pay you, that's not really the customer you were really going for anyway, because they're going to be, there's no pain for them. Pain isn't the right word, but there's no investment on their side to say that, you know, when they say, I want to ask for a new feature, I can easily ask for a new feature, but there's no investment for them to do it. Like, even for something as simple, I mean, payment is whatever you want to make it. Usually we're talking about dollars, but I've been playing with Facebook ads a lot lately, and there's an opportunity you can have for people. One of my magnets is a free newsletter. And one of the options that Facebook gives you is you can just, and one of the ad types is just click a button and they'll take the email they use in Facebook and automatically sign them up to their newsletter. Mm-hmm. We found that people that we gave that option to, they converted much lower because it was so easy to click a button to get it, but to get that newsletter. But if they would have to come to the website, put their name and their email address in, very small request, we found those people converted much higher. And so it was better money spent. Don't make the ads super simple to say, yeah, I want to get in on it really quick. It's like people walk by, are you interested? Yes. Are you interested? Yes. And I need a dollar. And
that optimizing for quality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You're going for more of a quality bar. It doesn't have to be a huge cost. It just has to be some sort of a cost to get them to do it.
Yes, absolutely agree. It was years ago now, but I remember that somebody put out a blog post where they analyzed the number of form fields on a sign up form, and they found, probably get this number wrong, but it turned out that their ideal number was 12 fields. And you kind of go, what? You want the least, right? And they were like, no, anybody who's willing to go through 12, the conversion rate on the people that came through was sky high. Any longer and they would start to fall off, but it was just right. And I love kind of understanding that sort of stuff. I think we're at about 6 form fields, but
got to dream up 6 more, obviously.
What's your favorite color? Blue.
That's right. Your first pet, and now you've just been fished. Gotcha. Yep.
That's right. Mother's maiden name.
Mother's maiden name. Boom. You might as well get the driver's license for them. Excellent. No, that's really fascinating. That's definitely great takeaways for people that, you know, either come out with new products in their own business already or side projects are trying to get off the ground. I think it's something lots of people in our industry struggle with. They really want to do their own thing, but either have the best technology and no ability to take it to market, or have some great marketing and no technology. So,
well, the last one on that as well, like even forget payment, the other problem, you make me realize that when we're talking about side projects, and we've all done this, and we all have friends who do this, the one where it's like, so you've been working on this side project for 2 years now, and it's not live, right? Yeah. And it's like, yeah, I've just got to do one more feature. Just, and it's like, oh my goodness, like, do you know how crap most products are out there? Like, you're already probably ahead of that. Like, and secondly, like, once it's out there, even with massive gaps, those users who want to be part of that journey and use that product and, you know, hopefully are also paying you, when they start asking for stuff, they're helping lead you to the right decisions there. And so, you know, it was a bit like that. Take, for example, when you talk about distributed tracing with Raygun APM. We could have delayed another couple of months and got that feature in. We could have delayed another few months and added another programming language. We could have. And it's just like, no. Let's just start getting people on there. The other thing I think people make a huge mistake on is they kind of go, you think to yourself, why would you delay to add another feature, right? And once you ask enough whys, right, you kind of get down to this point where for some reason people think that once they launch something, everybody's going to suddenly look at it and try it like that. And it's like, no, even if your product is just the most amazing thing ever, you are going to have to ram it down people's throats to get them to take it, right? You could launch today and in 3 months' time, you're going to be like, oh, a successful outcome might be a couple of hundred trials. More likely outcome is, because no one's ever heard of it, it's like 10, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not exactly letting down the market who are going to go, oh no, it was missing that feature. It's like, get started early. It's like investing. It's like building up a snowball. Just get it out there, start getting the awareness. Well, the extreme end of that, right, is that marketing idea that you set up a website that says it's coming, they can sign up to be notified, and then you run like AdWords against it and you're just judging to see how much interest people have. That's the extreme other end. I'm just saying, look, you can probably launch today. And hopefully, if anybody listening to this has one of those side projects, you know, they send you an email afterwards that says, you know what, after hearing this, I launched that weekend and I'm glad I did.
Oh, that'd be awesome to hear. If anybody is listening and has that, we would love to hear your story.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then we can pass it on to you, JD, and say, hey, look, you're responsible for these launches. There you go.
Well, and I only take a small cut of revenues too, so that's
great. And you tell them where all the problems in the software are, so it's a good double whammy.
They should absolutely put Raygun in.
Absolutely.
A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, and maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself, though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery from individual items to entire sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com. Inbox Zero is a thing of the past. We're all so inundated with email, and that's where Sanebox comes in. Think of it as an EMT for your email. As messages flow in, Sanebox does the triage for you. Sane Later sifts all distracting stuff out of your inbox so you can focus on only the important emails. That's just a taste. It also has nifty features like Sane Black Hole and Sane Reminders. Best of all, you can use Sanebox with any email client or phone, anywhere you check your email. See how Sanebox can magically remove distractions from your inbox with a free 2-week trial. Visit sanebox.com/MSCloudShow. Start your free trial and get a $25 credit.
Okay, JD, it is that time in the show. We like to put our guests on the spot and give them heads up. we've had a few too many awkward silences in the past that where we've really made it on the spot and we get all squirmy and a bit weird about it. So we're going for picks. So will you grace us with a pick of something you found interesting something you've read recently, a tool, a gadget, even an article, maybe tech-related or not?
Yeah, sure. So it is tech-related, and it's right up my alley of talking about performance. But one of the things that I've been really interested in recently has been the intrinsic stuff that's been turning up in .NET Core. And so what this allows you to do is, as probably all know, you know, your CPU has various instructions that run. We write normal code. However, there are some instructions that CPUs have that allow you to do some really cool stuff, like SIMD instructions. So you can do things like add four numbers together in a single clock cycle. And historically, you couldn't access these things from native .NET. You might have to wrap C or C++ related stuff to use that. Now in .NET Core 2.1 and beyond, and it's getting a lot better in 3, they have native inbuilt support for intrinsics. And so you can start doing some really cool stuff. And there's two articles, and I'll send you the link afterwards so you can put it in the show notes. One that I've really enjoyed is a series being run by a user online who goes by the name Damage Boy, where he takes an existing piece of code and he's putting together these posts where he optimizes and optimizes and optimizes with all this stuff, and it just gets faster and faster and faster. And the amount of improvement is ridiculous. And the second one is there's an official Microsoft post on the .NET blog about this that came out a couple of days ago. Kind of the same thing. I actually enjoyed Damage Boy's write-up a bit better, but you know, they're the same sort of thing. So I think That's really cool from a performance point of view.
I can imagine how your dev team are feeling having these articles fired over to them going, are you using this? Are you using this yet? Have you done that? That'd be pretty fun.
To my face, my team loves me, CJ.
There you go.
I'll throw this out there on performance as well, just because it's a bit of a fun story. But recently, I finally purchased a book called Michael Abrash's Graphics Programming Black Book Special Edition. And this book came
out... Like bedtime reading?
Yeah, it's 1,400 pages long. It's a pretty big book. And it's actually been open source now. You can download the PDF of it. I wanted the physical book. It was published in 1997. And this guy was working with John Carmack building Quake.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah, and so they're now both at Oculus, and this thing dives into performance optimizations that you could make back in the day. Usually, things like assembly code, inlining. How do you make this stuff fast? Which has been, it's just such a fun historical read. I'll read you a sentence here that I loved in the first page. Is performance still an issue in the era of cheap 486 computers and super fast Pentium computers? It's a great read. So that are my two kind of picks.
I like that because it's got a bit of history, but it's still probably super relevant, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's amazing as well because we're so used to these days writing in these higher-level languages that you do kind of forget, for example, how the CPU actually works and the fact that there are some crazy instructions on there that can do some really cool stuff with, but generally speaking, we don't really take advantage of them.
We're so abstracted away, yeah.
Yeah, at best, you hope that the base class libraries are doing some stuff in there, but you don't know.
Yeah. AC, what do you got for us this week?
So this discussion has been... I love this discussion. I know I've been quiet for most of it because I've just been eating it up. I'm a data guy and I might be one of the guys that really likes logging. So one of the things...
You can get a drink anytime.
I found this came across Hacker News the other day, and it's something that kind of speaks near and dear to me is I love probably collecting too much data. And then after collecting it all, it's, you know, how do you view it? And for me, that's all looking at something called charts.com as a JavaScript way of doing it. And going to charts.com/muse to see a bunch of stuff. So I love seeing all the different designs and everything that are there.
Nice, nice. Everybody seems to, they want to build this stuff. And it's always hard each time and you've got to go pick a library and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, this is pretty nice. I'm going to pass it on to our dev team and rebuild our charts. Analytics, cool. I have one this week. Actually, JD, you're a Kiwi and I'm a Kiwi. And so why not, we should stick with the Kiwi theme. This post is from Everyday Astronaut. We like space themes on the show. And it's called An Exclusive Look at Rocket Lab's Secret New Megafactory. And so this is the New Zealand rocket business, I suppose, Rocket Lab, who are starting to launch microsatellites and things like that on their Electron rocket. They've opened a new factory in Auckland, in New Zealand, and they invited a few people to the launch, sorry, to of the factory, including William Shatner. So Captain Kirk went and helped them open this, which is pretty hilarious. But the factory is pretty sweet. And so Everyday Astronaut has a post about his tour around their new factory. And I just found it kind of interesting. A, it's cool because it's in New Zealand, and it's always fun to see the stuff going on at home. And it's also cool because it's obviously space related. Great to see some interesting projects going on back there.
It is very cool. The whole tech scene in the broadest sense in New Zealand is just absolutely taking off, which is neat. I did enjoy, though, the fact that it's like, it's a secret thing. Here's all the photos. Like, yeah. So Kiwi.
I still don't get the concept of how, what's a big deal in New Zealand, Stephen. CJ, I mean, don't you just like release the rocket and it falls into space from down there? I mean, it's
pretty
like...
much. I mean, that's one of the benefits of launching from there, is they use a lot less fuel. It just sort of falls off. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. We like you don't to keep, so much launch as let go.
That's right. T-5 minutes to let it go. Yeah. Excellent. Hey, well, JD, thank you so much for joining us on the show again. It's been a real pleasure. We hope listeners have got some really interesting tidbits from yourself about building products at scale in the cloud, how Raygun can obviously help them, what you're doing with APM, and how you make some of your decisions about commercializing and building products and things. So as always, thanks again for coming on the show. Super interesting. And I hope it all goes well with APM. And go do it for Node, please. I just had to throw that out there. I'm waiting.
No, it's on the list. You've only told me about 40 times. Yeah. We'll talk afterwards about whether you want to do some Node.js development as a contract.
Perfect. There we go. All right. Cheers, everyone.
Thanks. Bye.
CJ's Hyperfish automates the collection of user profile information from users in organizational directories such as Office 365, SharePoint, Active Directory, and HR systems. The secure service supports on-premises, hybrid, and online environments. Bring your directory to life at hyperfish.com.
AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show. We'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as an MP3 or WAV file and provide a link so we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up for our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.